From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. 40 years ago this weekend, the Beatles arrived in the U.S. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate that anniversary. We feature interviews with Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, and Pete Best, the drummer who was replaced by Ringo. And we remember the Beatles' first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has named some of the members of his commission to investigate the intelligence the administration used in deciding to go to war with Iraq. He said the panel would also look at intelligence about weapons programs in other countries such as North Korea and Iran. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
In announcing the new commission, the president noted recent comments by former Chief Weapons Inspector David Kaye that pre-war intelligence about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction has not been confirmed.
We're determined to figure out why. We're also determined to make sure that American intelligence is as accurate as possible for every challenge in the future.
The president named former Democratic Senator Charles Robb and retired federal judge Lawrence Silberman to head the commission. He also appointed Republican Senator John McCain and four others to the panel and said two additional members will be named later. Although the president called it an independent investigation, Democrats have questioned the independence of a panel whose members are chosen solely by the president. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Federal prosecutors say they'll review the case of Jeremy Morse, a former Inglewood, California police officer who was accused of brutality during the arrest of a black teenager. Tom Rozak, a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office, says the prosecutors will decide whether Morse committed any civil rights violations.
Prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office, who will work closely in coordination with prosecutors from the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, will review all the evidence in this case, which will include the transcripts of the two trials in state court, to determine if any federal action may be warranted.
A Los Angeles judge dismissed an assault charge against Morse after the two trials ended in hung juries. Dick Gephardt endorsed presidential hopeful John Kerry today, but the many labor unions that backed the Missouri congressman are not immediately following Gephardt's lead. Matt Sepik reports for member station KWMU in St. Louis.
Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt received 21 labor union endorsements, many here in his home state of Missouri. Despite that support, Gephardt finished fourth in the Iowa caucuses last month and dropped out of the race. Bob Kelly, president of the Greater St. Louis Labor Council, says his group must follow the lead of the national AFL-CIO before endorsing a candidate.
I assume that it won't be long before it does happen. But unfortunately, we do go through a process to make sure that we do reflect the feelings of the people that we represent.
Other unions, including the Missouri National Education Association and the St. Louis Building and Construction Trades Council, say they will do the same. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in St. Louis.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 97 points, or nearly 1%, to close at 10,593. The NASDAQ was up 44 to 2064. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has ordered an investigation into accusations of sexual assaults by military personnel. The accusations were made by military women serving in the Persian Gulf region against men in their own units. The Australian headquarters of the company that makes the file-sharing software Kazaa was raided today by investigators from that country's recording industry. NPR's Neda Ulaby reports.
The office was raided early Friday morning by Music Industry Piracy Investigations, a branch of the Australian Recording Industry Association, according to a spokesman for Sharman Networks. Sharman distributes Kazaa software, one of the most popular internet tools used to share music, legitimately and otherwise. In December, a Dutch court ruled that the network was not responsible for what users do with its software. The Australian investigators were searching for evidence that could link the company to copyright violations. Four other internet businesses and three universities were also searched. Kazaa has been the object of numerous legal fights with the entertainment industry in this country, but there's no evidence that the American industry groups had anything to do with the Australian raid. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
NASA scientists say the newly repaired Spirit rover has resumed sending pictures from Mars. Mission manager Jennifer Trosper says experts have fixed computer problems that sidelined the robot explorer for 2 weeks.
It was nerve-wracking being 200 million miles away and reformatting our flash, but in the end, the spacecraft did exactly what we wanted it to do, and it performed perfectly, and it's in great health.
Over the weekend, mission managers say they'll start driving Spirit toward a crater about 800 feet away. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, dedicated to advancing entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org.
I'm David Bean-Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! Let's...
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be with you. And while I'm away, I'll ride home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that
it was 40 years ago on Monday that the Fab Four, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, perform live on American TV for the first time. That episode of The Ed Sullivan Show launched a musical revolution, and we're devoting today's Fresh Air to the Beatles. We'll hear from Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr and the Beatles' first drummer, Pete Best. But first, I wanted to talk about just how amazing this Ed Sullivan appearance was. You have to remember, or imagine, what TV was like then. There were three networks, no cable, and, because this may not be obvious to today's teenagers, no MTV. Rock and roll rarely, if ever, showed up on TV then. When it did, it was on talk or variety shows. Yet word got out fast that the Beatles were going to be on The Ed Sullivan Show. Their first single had just topped the charts in America, and young people were dying to see them perform live. Film of the Beatles had shown up on Jack Parr's Tonight Show, and even on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. But what was shown there was a lot of girls screaming insanely, and the Beatles themselves sporting what at the time seemed like insanely long haircuts. Virtually everyone I know who's about my age claims to have seen the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show that night. And I believe them all. That variety hour was seen by an estimated 71 million viewers, which at the time accounted for more than 40% of the nation. That's 142 times as many people who were at Woodstock. It's also, to this day, among the most popular TV shows ever broadcast. In terms of percentage of population, only one program, the finale of MASH, scores higher than the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Not even any Super Bowl ranks that high. Five songs were performed that night, three at the top of the show and two more near the end. Pity the poor juggling act, Wells and the Four Ks, who had to follow the Fab Four and close the show. But variety was what Sullivan's program was all about. Also on that same show, it's worth noting, was Davy Jones, one of the young cast members of the musical Oliver.
I'd do anything for you, dear, anything for you, mean everything to me. I know that I'd go.
After watching the Beatles from the Wings, it was only 2 years until Jones was starring as one of the Monkees, American TV's answer to the Beatles. I also find it fascinating that in the same Sullivan show, impressionist Frank Gorshin, who later played the Riddler on TV's Batman, based his routine that night on a premise that he and the audience found equally far-fetched and amusing.
Well, it's election year, and once again, a lot of the Hollywood stars will be out campaigning for the candidates of both parties because of their interest in politics. Well, a funny thing occurred to me. What if these stars should suddenly decide to run for these offices themselves? They'd have no trouble getting votes because of their popularity. In just a short time, the stars will be running the country.
That was before Ronald Reagan, much less Arnold Schwarzenegger, ran for governor of California. How times have changed. Yet after all this time, newly issued Beatles CD collections continue to sell millions and top the charts. Their impact was and is phenomenal. And we'll examine that phenomenon in today's show. The current occupant of the Ed Sullivan Theater, where the Beatles performed 40 years ago, is David Letterman. Monday on his CBS Late Show, Letterman will note that occasion in a variety of ways. One of them will be to replay in full one of the songs the Beatles performed that night, I Wanna Hold Your Hand. Before we welcome Ringo Starr, we'll play another song from that historic Ed Sullivan show, I Saw Her Standing There.
Well, she was just 17, you know what I mean, and the way she looked was way beyond compare.
When the Beatles played that song 40 years ago on The Ed Sullivan Show, the young man behind the drum kit was Ringo Starr. Terry spoke with him in 1995.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting like so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean,
we were young boys and it was exciting where we'd sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know. Just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this thing, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden. We've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And, of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And, of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, the first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show,
well,
yeah.
Ed, you see, I thought we come to America and it was fabulous and there was millions of people at the airport and they were lying in the streets and it was yeah, all over the place. And just my mind I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan. You know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, you know, they are, they're all the way from England, and it's great, and they're going to be fabulous, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
You probably couldn't
just
comprehend
like thrown,
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
we didn't know what it meant.
Square person.
Yeah, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, mm-hmm. and
so you actually knew where it started. I mean,
it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage, and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making and selling a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, I, you know, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
My love don't give me
a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday, they're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. Or, you know, the sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites, just because I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio? Is that
sure,
what you mean?
Even though we did it ourselves, you know, suddenly the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
Ringo Starr speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll hear more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Ringo Starr. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1995.
So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way, you see. Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory, a rock and roll band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. And I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall. and we were the rock band. And Brian called me on the phone and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles. And I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962. And I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session of the Beatles, and the producer,
George Martin,
had another drummer all picked out because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session, and so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down, and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I thought, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance, because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out, and that was it. So Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does. And he did on Friday when I was with him.
So
I always remind him.
What did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard. And that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, you know, if I could get into a better band, I would. And that's how I did it. You know, my aim was to play with good players. And that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, you know, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, you know, John came on the phone saying, welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard. which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back. And we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into like this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, Rory Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. You know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it sort of, like the comic clown, you know. John at their age, Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Ringo Starr speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. Our celebration of the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the British invasion continues in the second part of the show with interviews with Paul McCartney and Pete Best. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. And by TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true.
Coming up, the early days. We hear from Paul McCartney and from Pete Best, the original drummer for the Beatles, who was replaced by Ringo. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Dreamers, the new film by director Bernardo Bertolucci.
I'll pretend that I'm kissing the lips and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling, I'll be true. Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Before the Beatles came to America, they were making a name for themselves playing small clubs in Germany. In 1960, the Beatles went to Hamburg as a five-member band. This included Pete Best, the drummer who preceded Ringo Starr, and Stu Sutcliffe, the bass player who quit the band in 1961, the year before he died of a brain hemorrhage. Terry spoke with Best last summer. Here's the Beatles from a German nightclub performance in 1961, with Pete Best on drums and John Lennon singing lead.
Now, you were with the Beatles on their first German tour in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
What was that tour like?
It was a challenge. You've got to remember, we were, 17, 18-year-olds. We were supposed to be going out to Hamburg for a month, and we ended up being over there nearly close to 4 months. And, of course, when we went out there, we had no idea that we were going to be playing in Hamburg, which was the St. Pauli area of Hamburg, which was the red light entertainment district of the world at that time. We knew that Hamburg and Liverpool were ports, but there was nothing as erotic as this particular area. The clubs were great. I mean, it was wonderful from that point of view. It was an exciting place. The daunting thing was that when we actually got there, we were told that we would have to go to play six, seven nights a week. And that was where the challenge came in. But we quickly mastered ourselves to it. It was an exciting time. You know, there was lots of wine, there was lots of women. Hard work. We played hard on stage, and we played hard off stage as well.
Do you remember your first meeting with Brian Epstein?
Yes, we do, actually. It was, I suppose you could turn around and say, very informal. We were unaware of the fact that Brian had come down to watch us at the Cavern. But he'd watched us, he'd made a few inquiries, he realised, you know, who the Beatles were, and things must have been going through his mind. So word was passed to us after we'd played a dinner time session, which meant that we were playing for the public between 12 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, for the office workers and kids off school. And the message was passed to us, and very informally, basically, turned around and said, I would like to see you in my office round about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which fitted in with our timing perfectly. So we had a couple of pints in the grapes, and then off we trundled to meet Brian Epstein. And there he was in his formal attire of, you know, pinstripe suit, white shirt, polished shoes, you know, very clinical and clerical, but looking, you know, $1 million. And that was when he basically talked the deal around a little bit and said, it's a no strings a deal attached. I've always wanted to manage a rock band. You know, I might be able to help you, but, you know, the bottom line is there's no strings attached. If it doesn't work out, then you go your way and I'll go my way. And they gave us a bit of time to think it over. And we did, and we went back and I talked it over with my parents, and we talked it over amongst ourselves. And I suppose you could turn around and say that, you know, the overall opinion was that, yes, he should be manager. And that's how Brian became our manager.
Well, you did a couple of auditions with Brian Epstein in the hopes of getting a recording contract. The first was for Decca Records, and that was in early January of 1962. Why don't we hear one of the originals? This is called Like Dreamers Do, and Paul McCartney sings lead on this. It's really interesting to hear him sing, because aside from a couple of places, it sounds like a pretty different style than the one he became known for. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Paul had a hell of a range, and he could deliver most songs. And, it, you know, I suppose with it being an original number, he wanted it to be delivered the way he felt it should be. And it is different, but it's very contagious, you know, the way he delivers it. It's a semi, I suppose you could turn around and say semi-rock ballad, if there is such a thing. But it's a good song, and it was very catchy, and it caught on with the audiences all over the world.
Okay, well, let's hear Like Dreamers Do, recorded in 1962, featuring the Beatles with my guest, Pete Best, on drums.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her. You are that girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love you. And I waiting for your kiss, waiting for the bliss like dreamers do. And
shortly thereafter, you did another audition for EMI Records.
Yeah.
And on this, you recorded four tracks, Besame Mucho, P.S. I Love You, Ask Me Why, and Love Me Do. I guess it's probably, what, the first time you recorded Love Me Do?
It was, actually, yes. We'd played it many, many times. We improvised it in Germany, and that was when we first heard that we got the recording contract, and Brian Epstein... and I'm talking now about April 62 when we opened the Star Club. It was very much a case of Brian telegraphed us and turned around and said, congratulations, you got the recording contract, start rehearsing your own material. And that was when we tried that out on the German audiences. We tried different formats. We tried a guitar lick in there, as opposed to the world-famous harmonica, which, you know, the world knows today. We weren't happy with that. The arrangement, we changed that around a little bit. Then we introduced the harmonica into it because we wanted to make it a little bit more haunting. And there was a change of beat in there because what was happening in those days, change of drum pattern in a number was very commercial. You didn't hear it too many times. So consequently, here on my particular version, which was the one that we played to the audiences of, in Germany and Liverpool prior to the recording, has a change of beat in it, and it was, you know, they liked that change of beat, and we thought that it worked well.
On this audition version of Love Me Do, it's slower than the version that was actually released, and the harmonies are a little off. It's not very polished sounding.
Well, it wasn't. You've got to remember that wasn't a finished. You know, it wasn't
exactly
meant to be finished.
Yeah.
It was supposed to, you know, go. We were supposed to go back. It was just to give George Martin an idea of the type of material that we could write. The whole essence of it, that we were supposed to go back and put the finishing touches to it. So what, you know, the people hear, it's a slower version. It's a little bit more country orientated. If you listen to the harmonica, it's a little bit more haunting. And I think there's a little bit of sorrow in it because we were reflecting the fact that Stu, you know, had died a couple of days beforehand. We were still under that particular, you know, tragedy. That was still hanging over us. And I think it was reflected in the music as well.
Okay, here's the Beatles, recorded in 1962, with my guest Pete Best on drums. What was it like for you to watch the Beatles become the most famous band in the world? And you had been with them and weren't any longer.
Interesting, if I could put it that way, and mystifying as well. I suppose the heartache came when the first record, Love Me Do, went into the charts. The mercurial rise and the, you know, watching them become the, you know, the biggest phenomenon in the music industry was something which I don't think anyone expected. So that was like total fantasy. But the heartache for me was initially, you know, with Love Me Do, because that was the belief that we had in the band that we could break through into the English charts. And lo and behold, with their first record, you know, the first release on a major English label, you know, that was the success we'd believed in. So the rest of it, you know, was a little bit pipe dream.
Pete Best speaking to Terry Gross in September 2003. Next up, Paul. This is Fresh Air. We conclude our Beatles tribute with Paul McCartney, who shared that Ed Sullivan Show spotlight with his fellow Beatles 40 years ago. He spoke with Terry in 2001.
You know, when the Beatles started performing, the adults were up in arms about them, about your hair and about, you know, the silliness of the lyrics and everything. And but with Yesterday, like the nightclub adult performers started adding it to their acts.
Yeah.
Did that feel like a victory to you, or did you really not care what the adults were doing in their acts anyways?
No, it was very nice. It was very nice to have that because, you know, we thought what we were doing was quite good and we were proud of it. And there was this sort of backlash, particularly from the elder generation. People tell me stories now. They say they were watching that first Ed Sullivan show. And it's always the dad in the family who sort of says, them Beatles, and he never likes us. And he always says, you know, those are Whigs. They always thought, the dads always swore, the kids saying, we knew they weren't. But so it was always the problem. The dad was always the problem. So I suppose he was symbolic of the problem. So that when people started to like anything out of our repertoire, it was a certain victory, and Yesterday was a personal victory of mine. I mean, for instance, the great clarinetist Benny Goodman, who we had loved and thought was great talent, started for some reason, and maybe it was just a journalistic thing, but he came out against us. He said, I can't remember what he said, but of course we hated him from then on, and we started saying he's a lousy clarinetist anyway, what does he know, you know? So there was this sort of group that didn't like us, that thought we weren't very good. So when Yesterday came out, I think a lot of them had to change the tune, and it eventually got recorded by way too many of them.
Now, your songs were co-credited, you know, in the Beatles era. My understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, that many of the songs were written by one of you or the other, although the other would do some editing on the song, but a few of the songs were actually true collaborations. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, well, what happened was, in the early days, they were pretty much, the very earliest days were separate. We wrote one or two separately before we actually got together. But when we got together and actually started writing the earliest Beatles stuff, everything was co-written. We hardly ever wrote things separate. But then, after a few years, and as we got a bit of success with the Beatles, and didn't actually live together or weren't just always on the road together, sharing hotel rooms, then we had the luxury of writing stuff separately. So John would write something like Nowhere Man, sort of separately in his house in outside London, and I would write something like Yesterday, quite separately on my own. And as you say, we would come together and check them out against each other. Sometimes we would edit a line of each other's, but more often we'd just sort of say, yeah, that's great. And very often, a line that one of us was going to chuck out, we would encourage the other not to chuck out because it was a good line. I had a line in Hey Jude much later that said, the movement you need is on your shoulder. And I thought that was me just blocking out the line. And I said, I'll change that. He said, you won't, you know, that's the best line in it. And similarly, I would encourage him to keep lines in his songs that he didn't think were very good. And I'd say, no, that's a really great line. There was a song of his called Glass Onion, where he had a line about the walrus. Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul. And he wanted to keep it, but he needed to check it with me. He said, what do you think about that line? I said, it's a great line. You know, it's a spoof on the way everyone was always reading into our songs. I said, here we go. You know, we give them another clue to follow. So we would check stuff against each other. It was obviously very handy for our writing to be able to do that.
Were you ever sorry that your songs were co-credited? Did you ever wish that you could get the composing credit for your songs, that it was clearer?
Well, it was an arrangement we made in the early days, very early days. And, of course, you know, a lot of people don't realise that our admiration goes back to people like Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart. We loved a lot of the work of those people. And so we were looking for something similar. So Lennon McCartney grew up so that we would be a songwriting team in the tradition of those people. For the first few years, it was fine, and it never bothered us. But more recently, I must say, it started to bother me. What happened was, the kind of thing that would spark the feeling that they maybe should be better credited, the songs, was that Adrian Mitchell, who helped me edit my poetry book, did an anthology of verse where he had my poem, Blackbird, my song or poem, Blackbird, in it. And, of course, it was credited Blackbird by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, which was just not true. John hadn't had anything to do with that. So I started to think, you know, this is a bit of a nuisance because I don't want any credit if John's stuff gets separately put in something like a poetry anthology. You know, I don't want any credit for Give Peace a Chance, even though I am credited on that. Some of John's stuff was purely John, and I'd rather it be that. So that kind of started me thinking. And then when we had the Beatles anthology record came out, I actually did request that on the song Yesterday, which was solely penned by me, that for the first time in 30 years, I'd be allowed to actually have my name in front of John's, not remove John's name, but that we credited Yesterday by Paul McCartney and John Lennon. As I say, John actually didn't have anything to do with the song at all. He didn't sing on it or play on it or write it. So I thought that was fair enough. And in actual fact, I wasn't allowed to do that. That was vetoed. And it started me thinking that, you know, with the computer generation coming in and data being stored for the future, that there probably is a scenario in the future where someone will think that Hey Jude, Let It Be, Long and Winding Road, Blackbird were written by the guy who came first. Because you know the way computers often knock off
right. The
ends of sentences.
Yes.
I mean, I just went to see Miss Congenia the other night. Do you know what I mean? On the ticket, it didn't
right,
have
right,
time.
Right.
It didn't have time for the
litty. Yeah, yeah.
So this kind of thing happens. And I was actually in Italy, and I was looking at a pianist's songbook, the fake book that the pianist was using. And you tend to flick through and look for your own songs. You know, you see Fly Me to the Moon, very, very nice. You see Moon River, lovely. You see Hey Jude, you go, way. And this was credited, Hey Jude, by John Lennon. Just because his name comes first. So you've hit on a sore point of mine there.
Right.
I don't want to remove his name, but I must say, just for kind of Trades Descriptions Act, as we call it over here, I wouldn't mind on the songs that I just did without John to have my name first. I think it would inform future generations as to what was happening.
My guest is Paul McCartney. Okay, a lyric like, love, love me do, you know I love you, I'll always be true, so please love me do. Now, on the page, that won't look right, but it works well as a lyric. Or like, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's not going to read great on a page, but it sings great.
Or as my father would have said, Paul, there's enough of these Americanisms around. Couldn't you write, she loves you, yes, yes, yes?
Did he really say that?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, that's so adult.
Even though he was very working class, he was fussy about his words.
With a love like that, you know you should be glad. should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad.
Paul McCartney speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Bernardo Bertolucci's new movie, The Dreamers. This is Fresh Air.
One, two, three, four!
The Dreamers is the first feature film in 5 years from the 63-year-old Italian director Bernardo Bertolucci, best known for Last Tango in Paris and his Oscar-winning The Last Emperor. Set in Paris in 1968, it's an intimate and sexually explicit portrait of two young men and a woman who hole up in a townhouse reenacting scenes from movies while the city outside explodes. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Bernardo Bertolucci has the perfect subject in The Dreamers for his sensuous style and his psychoerotic sensibility. In the first few minutes, you get passion for movies and political demonstrations and a tantalizing whiff of the sex and hysteria to come. The young American narrator, Matthew, played by Michael Pitt, has come to Paris in the spring of 68 to watch movies at the Cinémathèque with what he calls a Freemasonry of film lovers. He wants to sit close to the screen, he says, so he can receive the images while they're still fresh, so that their power doesn't dissipate before they hit the back rows. That sounds pretty fanciful, but Bertolucci's images make you feel as if you're in that same metaphoric first row. Even when those images are edited in from other films, in direct quotations from Godard and Joseph von Sternberg and Chaplin, they're a vivid part of the characters' inner lives. Bertolucci probes the locus of the dream world and the real world in ways that reach back to the French New Wave, only with more control and much more ambivalence. The Dreamers comes from a novel by Gilbert Adair called The Holy Innocents. The title characters are Matthew's fellow movie lovers, Theo and Isabel, played by Louis Garrel and Ava Green. He meets this dark, sultry, and intense couple during a violent demonstration, after the government has fired the politically outspoken director of the Cinémathèque. But instead of taking to the streets for more political activism, the young American moves in with them. They're brother and sister, it turns out, the children of a well-off celebrity poet who leaves them alone in their house, which is dark and rambling, full of long corridors, like the Castle of the Beast in Cocteau. It's there that these borderline incestuous siblings admit Matthew into their freaky psychosexual playpen. And here that Matthew, exploring the connection between uncontrolled sex and unlimited freedom, is finally forced to grow up. Much of the media talk about The Dreamers focuses on its NC-17 rating. And while there's no hardcore action, the squirm factor is off the charts. Sick pop quizzes, like the one in which the penalty for not identifying a movie reference is having to masturbate in public. And there's the scene in which the three characters lie naked in bathwater, turning red from Isabel's menstrual blood. The novel's bisexuality is here only a tease, but the hetero stuff is explosive. Ava Green's Isabel strikes one delirious, self-infatuated, femme fatale pose after another. It's no wonder that Matthew goes along for the ride. But then he begins to find it all as gross and infantilized as some in the audience will, and he hears in Tao's Maoist declarations a similar infantile egocentricity. This is where Bertolucci, the old communist, might surprise you.
The Red Guards that you admire, they all carry the same book. They all sing the same songs. They all parrot the same slogans. So in this big epic movie, everybody is an extra. That's scary to me. That gives me the creeps. I'm sorry to say it, but for me, there is a distinct contradiction.
Why?
Because if you really believed what you were saying, you'd be out there.
Where?
Out there on the street.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes, you do. There's something going on out there. Something that feels like it could be really important. Something that feels like things could change. Even I get that. But you're not out there. You're inside with me, drinking expensive wine, talking about film, talking about Maoism. Why?
Okay, that's enough.
No, tell me why.
That's enough.
Ask yourself why. Because I don't think you really believe it. I don't think you...
You speak too much.
Michael Pitt isn't ideally cast. He has a great, wide-open Leo DiCaprio-like face, but he doesn't give off feverish intellectual vibes. He's an inarticulate stoner type. And his renunciation of Maoism and violent demonstration sounds a little smug to me. It's not that the sentiment is a problem. It's that it's not the anti-Vietnam War American in the middle of the moment talking. It's the 60-ish director and screenwriter with their 2020 hindsight. It's also quite an admission from a director who came of age as an artist in the late 60s and went on to stage his own movie-fed communist pageant, his epic 1900. With his lyrical interpolation of old film clips, Bertolucci both celebrates movie-fed glamour, then goes on to show the perils of a medium that can't help but favor masturbatory fantasy over political reality. The Dreamers doesn't achieve the mixture of longing and despair in Bertolucci's masterpiece, Last Tango in Paris, but it's a wonderfully suggestive teen-pick version of it.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Audrey Bentham and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Let me whisper in your ear.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for the Soul, The Girl's Guide to Finding Inspiration One Movie at a Time by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The photographs of Joseph Scheer capture a beauty invisible to the naked eye, the kaleidoscopic colors and intricate patterns of the common moth. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Scheer and moth expert Mark Epstein. Also, science writer Carl Zimmer tells us about the founder of modern neurology. Join us for the next Fresh Air.